Hello, my name is Claire Swift, and welcome to this, my first podcast, which I've titled The Death Star is Fully Operational. By Death Star, I'm actually referring to the EU, a union that, whilst it claims to be simply about economics, wants an army. An economic union that, whilst it's grown in size by 366%, has economically shrunk by almost half. And even by its own estimates, will in the next 10 to 15 years account for only about 10% of the world's GDP. No wonder then that outside of Europe, other countries have deliberately chosen not to copy it as an economic model, preferring instead simple, straightforward free trading agreements without loss of sovereignty. The EU might be failing economically, burdened with debt and unemployment. It has, however, been very successful in appearing to be one thing when in reality it is very much something else. We laugh whilst trying not to cry when we hear that millions of our EU-funded taxes are being spent on Elton John concerts, virtual swimming pools, gender equality wood design centres, and my personal favourite, a blogging donkey. Yes, folks, a donkey that blogs. And consider its four founding principles: the free movement of goods, services, people and capital. All of it feeds into a narrative of a benevolent liberal union overflowing with freedom for all. But is that what the EU is really about? The first 25 years after World War II saw rapid growth, which was equally met with very real and rapid income rises. We celebrated those early post-war years with a whole host of consumable goods like cars, fridges and TVs. But by the early 70s, the market of the capitalised countries of Europe had begun to mature. After all, how many fridges and TVs does one household need? But while we weren't buying at the rate, we had the labour force, the people that worked in the factories that made these goods, had become strong, united and politically astute. They demanded more and more rights, along with ever-increasing wages. The pendulum, which had appeared to rest neatly in the middle between a person's ability to earn and their ability to buy, began to swing very much in the direction of the worker. Business owners and those that ran large industries were no longer in charge. It was a worker. Things had to change, and change they did. Not by a single act, but with a degree of stealth. The pendulum was made to swing very much in the opposite direction, way, way past a kind of moderate middle and very much into the firm grip of corporations. Consider one of its principles, the free movement of people. All that freedom can only be a good thing, right? But the free movement of people means corporations get to pay their workers less and less. It's all very well having workers' rights, but when there's 1,000 others that will chiefly take your job with no rights and half the pay, you have in effect been rendered powerless. If a company has the legal right to freely set up anywhere, and if you're large enough, you can cope with the excessive red tape demanded by the EU by employing an army of accountants to offset those costs from your tax bill and thereby wiping out the competition from small businesses, that is rampant capitalism. So it's perhaps not surprising that the founding members of the EU, Monnet and Schuman, had US backing and money. The US, after all, is a country that regards even the hint of lowering profits made from people who are sick as somewhat blasphemous. You just know anything they're backing will put profits before people. Since its early days, the EU has been more than just the establishment of free trade between nations. The trouble is, no one really bothered to check the small print, and those that did went all misty-eyed at the future money they'd get, assuming others would be footing the bill. And so, in a series of treaties that few understood the true significance of, countries readily gave up their sovereignty. The question is why? Why would a nation give up its right to self-determination? The truth is, the majority of us weren't asked. Most of those treaties were signed without bothering to ask its citizens, and those that did, such as during the Lisbon Treaty, when the citizens gave the wrong answer, i.e. no, they changed the name of the treaty and told people to vote again. Today, almost 70% of our laws come from a commission that isn't voted in, but appointed. Laws are not made by the European Parliament, but by a commission, and its president, Jean-Claude Juncker, who was appointed, he gets to choose who sits on that board. The laws are then handed down to the Parliament, and all they can really do is offer up amendments. Now, the last time we run like that was in the 1600s, when Charles I was on the throne. And in those days, we had a strong sense of right and wrong, so we chopped his head off. The undemocratic and largely unaccountable EU of today is necessary so that it can become the EU of tomorrow, a federal state of Europe. Its mission, with every small piece of new legislation and regulation, gets it closer. The introduction of a single currency was an obvious step. Soon all birth, deaths and marriage certificates will be of EU issue. So you'll no longer be born or get married and die as British, but rather as a citizen of the EU. There are also other steps, seemingly pointless in nature. Take, for example, the toilet. The EU will standardise toilets throughout the EU. Apart from the obvious question of who will be paying for its implementation, which we already know the answer to, it's us, the important question is why? Well, because it's yet another small but significant step towards a homogeneous Europe, where there's no discernible difference between Spain and Scotland, apart from the weather, of course. But how much easier will it be to impose federalism, where everywhere looks and sounds the same, from our passports, car registration and marriage certificates, right down to the sound of a toilet flush? And with the free movement of people, despite the burden it puts on local services, there'll be no national identity. Any cultural riches will have been diluted into a homogeneous mash of workers, burdened with the debt of federalism for generations. And all for what? So that large multinational corporations and financial institutions get to dominate. The more money they make, and they won't get to do that if they have to pay anything like a decent wage, the more they can see off competition from smaller internal businesses and the external larger corporations of China, India and Russia. That's the economics. And as for the politics, well, the unelected president of the European Council, Herman Van Rompuy, said in an interview that the EU intends to control every country on the western flank of Russia. Two points of interest there. Firstly, the EU intends to control every country. That is hardly a statement you'd expect from an official of an economic union. And secondly, the western flank of Russia. Now, that has absolutely nothing to do with economics and everything to do with political might. With so little regard for democracy, corruption is perhaps inevitable. Millions spent on private airports, copper statues and unexplained earnings. There's even the case of the EU official who claimed almost $8 million for a ransom demand after staging his own kidnapping. His own auditors freely admit that corruption costs a staggering $99 billion a year. And with corruption on that scale, kind of makes FIFA look almost honest. And yet, despite all the accusations of being nothing short of a corporatist racket, corrupt and economically foundering, it seems our politicians only took sense when in opposition. In 1983, during his election address, Tony Blair stated that the EU had drained our natural resources and destroyed jobs, and promised to negotiate withdrawal. Yet, just before the 2015 general election, he claimed we should be denied an EU referendum because we might not reach the sensible choice of staying in. And then, a short while later, it's announced that it's to take up a job at, guess, well, the EU. Thereby joining a long list of ex-politicians and civil servants who have jumped on the gravy train, the most famous of which, of course, is Neil Kinnock. After losing the 92 election, he got himself a job at the EU. He was so impressed with the pay and an expense account for which you have to show little in the way of receipts for, that he got his wife Glynis, a school teacher, a job there too, plus his daughter Rebecca, and for a while even his son Stephen. Over the years, the Kinnocks have amassed over £10 million and are in receipt of six different pensions. To realise that politicians of all persuasions and civil servants maintain a pro-EU stance out of self-interest is maybe not such a big surprise. But what about the others? The CBI, the supposedly independent employees organisation. It's pro-EU, but the EU happens to be its biggest single donor. The BBC, the EU has donated over £20 million to it. Richard Branson, he wants us to remain in the EU, yet he moved his company to Switzerland, which is not in the EU, and personally, he's a Caribbean tax exile. He wants the UK to remain in the EU because currently he has over £500 million worth of NHS contracts, and with the conclusion of the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, often referred to as TTIP, he starts to make a lot more. Airbus stated recently that the EU is good for the UK, but if you look on their website and check out their plane orders, you'll find that 84% of plane orders are from non-EU countries. And in the same way you don't need to be in the EU to freely trade with it, nor do you need to be in the EU to fly a plane over it. So why the pro-EU stance? It might be something to do with the fact that Airbus is partly owned by the Spanish, German and French government. Since its inception, the tax-funded EU has systematically bought off any possible dissent from either politicians or mainstream media. So now we come to the birthplace of democracy, Greece. Recent weeks have been filled with the woes of Greece, the will there won't be a Grexit, banks limited to handing out 60 euros a day, a referendum held and then promptly ignored, followed by more tax rises, deeper spending cuts, and the rich and famous like Johnny Depp swooping in and grabbing a bargain now that vast amounts of Greek public land, including some of its islands, are being sold off. Successive Greek governments failed to implement an effective taxation system, which meant paying taxes was almost a lifestyle choice. So it's no wonder that Greece went bust, but it went bust owing 30 billion. It now owes 300 billion because the vast amount of money that's been loaned to Greece hasn't in fact gone to Greece at all. It's been used to pay out private sector banks, including those of Germany and France. And what a heavy price the Greeks are paying to support the financial institutions of other countries. Thousands have died from what the doctors regard as unnecessary deaths, lack of medicines and ambulances running out of petrol, suicides up by 37%, HIV infections up, malaria has returned, and firemen begging in the streets. Throughout the peripheral EU states like Ireland, Portugal and Greece, in return for loans, they've had to increase taxes, cut public spending, and sell off large amounts of public land as quickly as possible. Now, you don't need a degree in economics to know that if everyone knows you have to sell, you're not going to get a good price. And it's the taxpayer that loses out yet again, because these assets, which, let's face it, you can only sell once, have been sold off sometimes at half their real value. Further proof that the large corporations benefit. They get debts paid off by the taxpayers, and as a thank you, they get to buy their assets cheap too. But not all banks got to play fast and loose and then get all their money back when they lost. The Cypriot bank Laiki was allowed to go bust, but the interesting difference there is that unlike all the other banks, its creditors were mostly Russian. The EU officials, with no democratic legitimacy whatsoever, imposed capital controls on Greece, which effectively limited its ability to breathe as a nation until it complied with its demands to take on more debt, the majority of which it never owed in the first place. In the Star Wars film, the Federation seeks to impose its will through force. How has the EU, although not a federation yet, has behaved any differently? So, whilst the Death Star's not complete, it's certainly fully operational.